Bob, Robert Zingrillo, or Roberto here in Miami. Known, so you are a very known investor. I would say that every person that's a somebody got to know who Bob Zingrillo is. We had a pleasure of meeting, I think it was 2015 or 2016, first time?
A while ago.
A while ago, right? Yeah. And
I think 2015.
2015, right? We met, and at that time, you invited me to your house in LA, and you also had your house here in construction at that time. Mm-hmm. And now it's, we'll get to that. So you're also, so you're the chairman and CEO of Dragon Global?
Correct.
Right? You have a very interesting story. And I'm like, why don't you tell us, Nacho, a little bit about yourself? How did you get to be a permanent figure in the investment world? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I grew up in Norwalk, Connecticut, from humble background. First person in my family line to go to college. And after college, I was going to pursue the traditional, be an investment banker and go down that road. And I ended up deciding to be an entrepreneur and started a business with one of our friends from Wharton to do upscale billiard clubs. So, you know, cash flow businesses, mm-hmm. real estate, you know, find an up emerging neighborhood, mm-hmm. generate cash, hold on the asset, make money. I then moved out to Los Angeles to do this in Los Angeles, and I was raising money, and I ended up pitching an international family office from Venezuela. And I thought it was the best meeting I had. And, you know, they said, hey, listen, we want to hire you. We don't want to invest in your business. So that's how I became an entrepreneur. Shadowed a family office, ran their venture and their technology. And that led to me, you know, learning from a mentor.
So you're managing their money.
Yeah. So I was basically managing their money. And the patriarch of the family was really managing the money. I was responsible for investing. So I dealt with all the private investments, all the public investments, and all the real estate investments, and all the insurance.
How big was their
family? About $1 billion.
Okay. What years?
And this was 1989
okay.
to 1992.
Okay.
And then they privatized the cellular network in Venezuela in 1989, 1990, when I first started working there. I helped them raise $50 million in debt for the enterprise because people thought nobody's going to ever use cell phones in the third world. Became the fastest growing technology play, fastest growing cellular network in Latin America, actually in the world at that point in time. And I was like, forget about real estate. I'm going back to business school and I'm going to be a leader in tech. And in 1992 to 1994, I went to Stanford Business School and got my MBA and, you know, focused all my energy, not on real estate more, but on building.
So you're the first person in your family to go to college and
yeah, this was Stanford. Actually the business school. So I was the first person to go to undergrad and the first person.
What was your undergrad? Where did you go to?
I went to University of Vermont. Okay. I was a skier, a competitive skier. So I went to UVM and did my undergraduate degree, which is a great lesson for any entrepreneur because I was going to go to Brown and I decided to go to University of Vermont for the first semester because I got in second semester and I ended up staying. And I don't think I would have ever gotten into Stanford Business School if I had gone to an Ivy League undergrad school. So don't put too much pressure on yourself. Enjoy life. And
I love it.
And good things will come.
I love it. I love it. So you basically worked for Venezuelan family that had their family fund, about $1 billion. You worked with them. Then from there, you decided to just quit or 20.
Well, I wasn't going to quit. So I was going back to business school, still working for them because I was all self-made. Mm-hmm. So I had to pay for it. And I was doing projects for them. And I was going to do a fund when I came out and be a general partner. One of my best friends ran the Carrefour family office, a big retailer mm-hmm. that invested here in the Dick's Sporting Goods, PetSmart, Costco, mm-hmm. number of companies, Starbucks. And so he and I were working with DLJ, the investment banking firm, to create a fund called Global Retail Partners. And so during business school, I did a summer associate role there, worked with the group. We were working on the fund. And then after business school, I ended up seeding two of my friends and becoming an interim chairman CEO of an enterprise software company. By the time the fund got done, I ended up picking running the company. It became the first investment of the fund.
You know, I got to ask when I hear this, when was it that you turned out a self-made millionaire? At what point chronologically over there? And until what year we're talking about?
So I had my big run, and I tell everybody, you have your run in like 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, that's where you make if it's all working. Yeah.
So my first run was in, I'd say, between 1995 and 1999. Mm-hmm. I was chairman CEO and built a $3 billion publicly traded software company doing enterprise software for e-commerce. Mm-hmm. So I went from like a net worth of, closed my real estate deal, sub $1 million net worth to $400 million net worth in like 4.5 years.
And back then, $400 million was worth $400 million.
Yeah.
Today, $400 million is more like $40 million. So it's that was pre-inflation, crazy inflation.
I didn't keep all $400 million because I also was trying to make $10
billion. Okay.
And so I went through, you know, the dot-com correction, which was not fun.
Yes.
But I would, at that point, had retired, lived in Aspen, and you know, and then I came back and had to do it again.
How did you, can I ask how you had so much success with that enterprise company? Because, I mean, to go from a run of where it started to a several billion dollar publicly traded company, that's huge, right? And that's usually not on somebody's first shot.
And back in,
no kidding. So what was it?
There were many multi-billion dollar companies.
No. So what was it? What was the secret sauce? What was the product market fit? Like hindsight's 2020, so you can unpack that.
I think my biggest skill set is to be able to take a step back and see the future. And I know that's a pretty aggressive thing to say, but I've always, growing up, I read a lot of books. I studied psychology. I studied ancient civilizations. I've studied the most successful people in the world. I've read all the self-help books. I've read everything you possibly can. I developed mentors, like old school mentors, like the Carnegie Mellons of the world, to, you know, the Warren Buffett's of the world, to the Bill Gates of the world. So, you know, the one thing I saw, I was at the time was investing in technology for B2B commerce that was based over TCP/IP for sourcing. And we were doing superstore big box retailers. So I wrote the business plan for Dick's Sporting Goods. I did the PetSmart IPO as a banker. I was an early investor in Ulta Cosmetics, you know, and, you know, so I saw moving from mom and pop stores to moving to superstores. When I saw the first Mosaic browser come down, I said, wait a minute, we're not going to move just to superstores. We're going to move to online commerce. I did an analysis of what companies can I invest in that will be the enabler to make sure that electronic commerce would work. So I studied all the enterprise software companies like SAP and all the big manufacturing software and financial accounting software. Nobody had ever dealt with the scalability of letting millions of people hit an enterprise app to order to conduct commerce. So the product market fit was if I could build the technology, I could build the enterprise software platform and go after the distributors, the manufacturers, and the retailers, I could build an enterprise software company on an architecture that would allow for the scalability that the traditional players like SAP or PeopleSoft didn't have. That was the initial product.
The idea is that what you just explained was probably hard to embrace for most people just listening to this. And that was already in the 90s where you're able to see it, right? You're able to notice that in the 90s, not just put it in your head, actually go and put it in fruition, actually build a team, develop that, and then go and explain people, this is how it's going to look like, come buy my product. Right. And eventually develop that. That's a skill.
And now I understand. Now I probably understand a little bit of the investment thesis that's allowed you to be successful over the years.
Yeah.
Because that mindset's definitely
forward looking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And then you have to have, to be a successful entrepreneur, you have to have the cojones or the, you know, you have to have the confidence to say, I'm going to bet everything on this one thing.
Yeah.
So I'm very good looking at, imagine that you have a bullseye, focusing right in the middle of the bullseye and being relentless to say, hey, it's all about timing now. So, you know, there's going to be a total addressable market. The question is, when is that going to develop? So back then, you didn't have a browser. It was took too long to download. You didn't even have a shopping cart. You didn't have any of this. So we had to build all of that ourselves. We focused with the computer magazines, the Micro Warehouse, the Multiple Zones were early customers because at least their client bought product and were tech enabled. But when I went after retailers and I got Toys R Us and I got Nike and I got all these other clients, I had to deal with the CEOs of the companies and the board of directors to teach them why would we put our business online.
Can you imagine building into a TAM that hasn't even existed yet?
Yeah.
That's scary. That's scary.
You're either a developer, you understand it's there, but it's a seed. It's nothing.
Yeah.
You have to see the future. And this is where not everyone has that vision. Most people go into a business in a space where might not be competitive, but they see the size of the space and they go in. You're going into something that wasn't existed yet. And you just, but based on the run rate, but I got to ask, so when do you get out, right? Because you did good going in. So you said you went to Ulta, and I remember we spoke about Ulta. Yeah. And I might be wrong, but I mean, it was 2015, right? So you told me you came in with $1 million, you pull out 30 million and you thought you're a genius, but it would have been hundreds right now. And then the question is, when do we get out?
Right. So I've looked back over my own portfolio and my conclusion is I never want to get out. So I've become an extremely long-term investor. So unless you realize that your entrepreneur and your team is not scalable, which means your leader, your management team, and your board, and they are not able to, what I do, leverage OKRs and to develop new markets. So if you look at Alibaba, you look at WeChat, or you look at Microsoft, and where you look at Amazon, you look at the cloud. If an organization is not able to challenge itself and displace itself and open up new markets, then they're a one-trick pony, you got to get out, right? It's when they have the ability to challenge themselves in a way that pushes their organization, set clear goals, and displace themselves, right? I'd rather be displaced by ourselves than displaced by a competitor would be what Steve Jobs or Bill Gates would say. Mm-hmm. And those are the companies I try to find and I try to stay with.
So if you go to a company like Meta and you put some money in, and we'll touch Meta in a minute, because it's a big story with Meta, but if you go to a company like Meta, they don't do dividends. So you put the money in and you technically never get to see them. I get it. On paper, it goes higher and higher and higher. But do you ever take some profit out by selling some and paying your taxes? How does it work? What do you do with that?
Or
do you
I made the mistake having invested in owning over 1% of Meta, which was Facebook at the time. So my quick story on Meta was, I was the chairman of a company called Playlist. So if anybody remembers MySpace, there used to be these music playlists associated with your thing. I did it with Insight, the founders of Insight Ventures. So we were investing in companies like Photo Bucket or Playlist early on. And the LPs didn't like it because we were selling them, making a fortune. So I was the chairman of Playlist. I realized that the guys at MySpace, and I was friends with Aber, who was the CTO and the CEO, that these companies really were running like nightclubs because the users really didn't know each other. And having studied the difference in the glue that pulled together the social network at MySpace and the glue that pulled together the social network at Facebook, I realized that Mark was smart enough to use the 150 closest relationships, your influence, your mavens, and your connectors, and your family to go build their graph. So their graph was stronger, more viral, and stickier than MySpace. So I said, hey, listen, I think Mark Zuckerberg is an incredible entrepreneur. My friend Owen Bonato was the COO at the time. And I said, listen, I want to just put all of my money behind Mark Zuckerberg. And I believe in social networking, building a moat around data.
How about drive that? Then?
Right? Now, the company was on a run rate in 2008 to do $280 million in revenue that year. And I was able to come in between $2 billion and $4 billion during the year to do secondary purchases from existing management, some of Mark's family, his father, and a couple of the early engineers. And my whole pitch to them was, I'm going to help you diversify it. Don't sell me everything you have. Sell me 5, 10%. Take some money off the table, live in a nicer house, go out to nicer meals. If Facebook becomes what we think it's going to become, you're not going to need the money anyway. If it becomes victim to MySpace or becomes a club and shuts down, you at least have a nice yeah. house and you have some money. So that was my strategy at the time for building a position. And I should have never, ever sold. So when the stock went from about $1 a share, went public at $40 a share. So we had like between 8x and a 40x going into the IPO. And then when we had this shift to mobile, the stock fell in half. So mm-hmm. it went from $40 a share to $20 a share. I got aggressive. I lost a lot of my promote in my fund. So it cost me like $100 million. It was not a good day. But I was able to buy, and my personal ownership went from 3.3 million shares to 10 million shares, mm-hmm. right? So I was like super, super aggressive on, I know I'm right. I know Mark's right. I know he's mm-hmm. going to build an unbelievable company. And I knew that mobile would be bigger than desktop, mm-hmm. right? Because you're going to spend more mm-hmm. time. It's about how much time do I spend? What's the quality of time I spend? How am I engaged?
One of the reasons MySpace died was on mobile, because they never adapted.
They never adapted, and they never competed against Mark
yeah.
in a way. And people just moved over to really communicate. Mark built a communications platform. So I should have never sold, right? In fact, at the peak, that one position would be $3.2 billion, yeah. right? I lived wow. through a couple of corrections, some quarters missed, some bad transitions, some adjusting to the public. And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna leave some money here, but I am going to diverse. And I had also put $120 million into Zynga. I had put, wow. you know, $40 million into Uber. I had a number of other companies I did.
And were they all secondaries?
A combination of primary and secondary. Mm. So I typically check size for Dragon is 50 to 150 million primary or secondary. I moved more into primaries and secondaries because I became everybody.
Do you mind explaining the difference between the two, primary and secondary?
So primary is when you're buying stock directly from the company. Mm-hmm. There's a couple differences. One, it typically comes with a preference. So whereas if you buy from an individual, there you're typically buying common stock or early investment stock. So there is no preference. So it's much riskier to buy secondary stock than it is primary stock, especially in markets like this where markets are going to be corrected. If you're in the right company, it doesn't really matter,
yeah.
right? Second thing, if less than 20% of your holdings are secondary, you don't have to be a registered investment advisor because you can use the venture capital exception, right? So it's a less regulatory oversight by doing primary over secondary. It's safer. And, you know, you just have to be a little bit more connected and you have to have a track record.
Now, you did get in some troubles. You want to, and I just briefly heard that some of the engineers that sold you secondary meta stocks, they went after you saying, well, we didn't know it's going to go so high. You owe us money because and eventually sold it too cheap. Is that correct?
No.
That's not what happened?
Never happened.
Oh, okay. Okay. That was it. No. I don't know. I mean, just rumors going around. Okay, that was in LA. We're sitting down in Buya and someone said that. It doesn't make sense someone would even consider doing that because how is it? It was a fair trade.
No. So I had one friend at the time.
Okay.
Who, this is probably the rumor, if you heard in LA, who I said, invest everything you have
okay.
in Facebook.
Okay.
It's like, give me $3 million. He signed a $3 million commitment letter. One of my other friends convinced him he shouldn't do anything. So he said, I'm not doing anything. Forced him to put $500,000 in, right? So his argument was, you should have maybe put $3 million in. I was like, I had to twist your arm to put the $500,000 in.
That's so funny.
Right? It wasn't an engineer. It was a person who was an investor.
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, at that point in time, with a company doing $280 million in revenue and a $2 billion valuation or a $4 billion valuation, it was expensive. Mm-hmm. Nobody had ever seen those values. So I could understand yeah. why people were giving him the advice not to. I was just so passionate about it. I'm like, go all in. And the argument wasn't that, hey, you know,
yeah.
you I was the engineer that you
It's interesting. LA, LA
no, a, you didn't make me put more stock in.
Yeah. It's funny when you go to certain places. So you really kind of left LA. Are you still spending time in LA at your place?
Or no, I have a house there. I go back there. But California just went the wrong way. Which goes to one of my biggest calls about 10 years ago. I had built my first enterprise software company in New York. I had lived in the Bay Area for 12 years. Then I built another enterprise software company going between New York and the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And then I had a house in LA, you know, because the Bay Area is boring, mm-hmm. and it was just closer place to go on the weekend. And then I ended up, you know, deciding that LA was a good market because I saw now that the platform of the internet was done, that people would start building companies in Los Angeles, and you'd have, just like we had Silicon Valley in New York, yeah. you're going to have Los Angeles. Well, I decided at that point in time that California was losing a lot of power and that Miami was going to be the new global tech city.
That was 10 years ago.
This is 2012.
Wow. Okay. That is a good call.
And I'm wow. like, you know
what? I didn't see that.
I'm like, I'm going all in on Miami. Now, to your point, I sold about $100 million worth of Meta stock. And I diversified into real estate, not just my home, but mm-hmm. I bought, you know, 18 acres of property north of Design District. Mm-hmm. I bought properties in Wynwood. I bought properties in the river. And I literally saw Miami becoming New York City, mm-hmm. right? And you want to talk, you think people laughed at me about going into Facebook at $2 or $4 billion. They thought I was absolutely crazy and insane to mm-hmm. think that Miami was not only going to be a global city, but it was going to be a global tech city.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I remember when we spoke in 2015, you told me, look, we bought this properties. It's in Little Haiti. It's going to be big. And, you know, I was thinking, well, okay, when I had no idea how long it takes to get permits, get things rolling. It's been, how long were you building?
10 years.
So you're building Magic City. Anyone that have heard of it, those who know, but Magic City is going to be kind of like the beginning of, I would say, the Silicon Valley type, I would say, space within Miami. Is that fair to say?
I don't even know this, so maybe give me a rundown of what this is supposed to be or what it's supposed to yeah. become.
So my vision was, and my friends are like, can you see the future? You're actually creating the yeah. future. So I'm not quite sure on this yet. But what Miami was missing was a walkable city.
Let me get just closer to Mike.
Which is a walkable city with a combination of residential, apartments, promenades. So you imagine a meatpacking district mm-hmm. where you have like almost a high line, where you have a walkable city. So there's no commuting on the highest point of Miami with unobstructed views, with highway access, a train station. And, you know, we're building over 2 million square feet of office space, 4.5 acres of public space on a promenade with 100-year-old trees, over 8 25-story residential buildings housing over 2,600 units, a 432-room hotel, and then retail, you know, mm-hmm. both on rooftops and on the promenade. So in order to do that, there's, call it the first 5 years of a project like that, is you've got to assemble the land. You've got to put all the pieces together. And under Miami Code 21, if you have over 9 contiguous acres, you can do a master upgrade in zoning. They've closed that door after Magic City, but we were the last one to do that. So the first 5 years, you're in stealth mode. It's like a puzzle. You're putting the puzzle pieces together. When we got the first 15 acres, I took on two partners. I took on Guy LaLiberté, who built Cirque du Soleil, because he understood placemaking, he understood the new tech, and a vertical developer in Plaza Equity Partners. We then took two more years to assemble the last 3 acres, which I personally was able to negotiate, you know, basically pleading for people to sell me the property because it fit mm-hmm. and completed the puzzle. And then it took 2 years of lobbying with the commission, working with the mayor, working with the residents of Little Haiti to allow us to rezone the neighborhood. And we were able to rezone from about 1.5 million square feet to now 8 million square feet gross. So we wow. literally took buildings from 5 stories to 25 stories
Major
and
defense.
Took density up and got a promenade and lobby for a train station. So it's been a Amazing. Lot of work, but unlike a Wynwood, we will be able to master develop a city.
So when you take on a project like that, obviously you're investing a lot in Miami, the thought and the future concept of Miami. So where do you think Miami is going as a tech hub?
So I think that we're seeing distribution out of the Bay Area, which mm-hmm. I came out of the Bay Area between Stanford Business School and running a software company out of there, that we're distributing to global tech hubs. In the United States, you know, the Bay Area has moved to secondary cities. We've always had Boston. New York has become the second global tech hub, and then Austin is becoming another global tech hub. So you have primary tech hubs and secondary tech hubs. So if you get a job, like one of my friends runs AI for Reels, and he got a job for Meta. Mm-hmm. You need to either work at headquarters in Menlo Park, or you can work in New York. So what's happening now is because of, you know, the lack of desire to commute, the lack of living in the city, the demand for lifestyle, the demand for more remote working, that cities like Miami are much more appealable to the millennials, you know, both the engineering teams and just the millennials. So you see moving out of blue states into red states. So you see Miami and Austin becoming probably the two biggest tech potentials for global tech cities outside of the Bay Area.
Yeah. You know, so Miami had its renaissance because of COVID, but it was something that started before. But I mean, Miami wasn't a place where you wanted to hire labor for tech. It was not the place. Still, up to COVID time, I was struggling. When I needed tech people, you know, we needed to find them in Israel. We needed to find them in Canada, in Toronto.
It was just hard.
Because if you're trying to find the ones in the US, I had to compete with Google, and they didn't know the beauty box concept. The good ones wouldn't come to me. But what I did see is that when you come to an event like in your place, right? So you have a big mansion and on one of the islands, and everyone's there, right? From the Peter Thiels to really interesting people, right? Plus the most beautiful women in Miami. So it's kind of like, if you were lucky enough to be able to come into the Bob's and Grillo's party, you're one of those motherfuckers. You go in, and once you try to get over for a second from all the chicks out there that are the prettiest ones, then you find the most interesting people, and you sit down and you talk to them, and they really enrich your data and your relationship and everything else, and you come out much better. You don't have to reinvent everything. Suddenly you'll talk to someone and tell you, oh, well, that's how we do it over here. Oh, wow, that's a better process. So you come out stronger. And it's kind of like from the Gatsby's parties that you're not looking for that woman to find you, like Gatsby, but it is what it is. You kind of like connected everybody together. And it was probably, and I would say that if there is a good reason to say why Miami became what it is today, there are a lot of parties that were inspired by your events from the same kind of circles in the same area, in the islands, that kind of put all those beautiful brains together in events that are fun, that everybody wants to go to. And now we have a community where people just got better. And I feel like this is probably for entrepreneurs, that was probably the first step. It's those few people that makes the difference. It's those. So I say, if we're gonna look back 10, 20 years from now, and we're going to say, okay, how did Miami took over San Fran? Well, you know, it started with a couple events, COVID. There was this guy named Bob's and Grillo. He used to throw those parties, and then that formed that relationship with those two that opened that global company. That's how it started. And then obviously the Magic City, that in a couple of years, people would probably hear the name, and it's going to be like saying Wynwood for everybody.
But do you need the YCs of the world to have more of a presence in Miami before it's known? Because YC is still mostly West Coast.
You know, you don't. You want to hear? I'll give you a couple of interesting statistics. So, you know, I was one of the pioneers that was really early down here, and I had to take the bet. And the only reason why is because when I built my company in New York City, Interworld, I realized that I could have made billions of dollars buying all the real estate in Lower Manhattan, mm-hmm. which I didn't do. I'm like, this time I'm going to get there. I've got to get there 2 to 3 years before everybody, because I've got to acquire the real estate, assemble it, entitle it, and be in the right place at the right time before the pure tech people came. So I came.
So you caused COVID, probably. That's what happened. You. I have an idea. I see the future.
Faster, right?
I'll cough in front of everybody.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
So I had friends of mine, in fact, they're advisors and co-investors. So Emil Michael, who was the chief business officer of Uber that raised $16 billion, came down. He stayed with me, with his wife, Julie. Actually, they weren't even married at the time. So you had some early, Shervin was an early mover down. Then Keith Rabose came down with Peter Thiel. So you have the tech people coming down early, which basically says, listen, we'll fund you. And one of the things I needed to do, to your point, it was very hard to recruit the best engineers down here. But once you got them, it wasn't as competitive as the Bay Area. So I actually started by funding a company, which today now has over $150 million in revenue and extremely 20% profit margins. So I said, hey, I'm going to go build a unicorn myself, right? So if I can do that, then I can prove to the venture capitalists and the other
entrepreneurs based in Miami, all in
place. You could do it here.
And all here in Miami, all your engineers, everybody, they're all here.
And so now most of the engineers work remote now anyway.
Okay.
And a lot of engineers are moving here. To your point, because I don't want to ignore your question is, do you need a Y Combinator to come? So one of my friends, Anil, runs a venture firm called Soma, right? They're the number one seed investor in the United States now. They have the biggest platform. Most of their entrepreneurs and their unicorns, I think they have over 25 unicorns, have come from Y Combinator. So their whole key position was they get first shots at the Y Combinator, and they're in there early. Of the 300, I think, investments they've made recently, only 5% of those are investments were entrepreneurs in Miami. Over 9 of, I think, 20 unicorns that they have are based on companies they backed in Miami. So the Miami growth rate track record out of even companies that are focused on by funds solely investing seed in Series A in Y Combinator, they're finding disproportionate amount of unicorns coming right from Miami.
That's amazing.
I didn't know that.
And Miami was the number, the third most entrepreneurial city in the United States before COVID, before any of this.
See, like,
they just
point,
couldn't scale.
Yeah.
Right? They're entrepreneurs or people, they come from Buenos Aires, they come from Tel Aviv, they
immigrants,
come from,
yeah.
you know, they're hardworking, dedicated people. They just needed, you know, the seasoned executives. Now the issue is we have more of the CEOs coming and the venture capital is coming. Then we have the middle management coming. So now it's up to us to write the checks, build the connections, and build those examples. And they're all coming.
The challenge companies have when they scale is to say, well, if I'm going to hire someone from New York City, and everything was pre-COVID, I think this is where it stopped now. It's to say, well, if I hire someone out of New York and ask him to relocate to Miami, and they have, if they don't have kids, it's easy because, you know, it's nice. But if they have kids, they said, well, I have to relocate my children over here to Miami. And then if it doesn't work out over here, I got to go to New York because there's no major companies in Miami. But once you start having some major companies in Miami, you start having some more critical mass of opportunities. They said, well, it doesn't work here. I have quite a few friends in Miami and there's some other opportunities now. I can feel comfortable moving down. And when COVID happened, it accelerated everything. Yeah. So companies open offices over there. So it was still, you're hireable in companies here, in a remote location that they decided to open here. I mean, Goldman Sachs wanted to, they did open a place. Everybody had to open a place. If it's a PE, they had to open a place in Miami. Everyone moved down here.
Correct.
Yeah.
And a lot of people moved from the Bay Area to Austin, and then they got bored and left from Austin and came to Miami.
You've seen that too.
The best equity partners or people like that. And I'm good friends with Fareed and MT. And so most of them moved to Austin. They're like, okay, this is great, but it's boring, right? And then they moved to Miami. So you see a lot of people. My friend Daniel Krissick, who runs all the biotech for Citadel, was instrumental and lobbying Ken to say, hey, Miami's gonna be the future, you know, where most of us are remote, all the partners are gonna wanna work and much more tax favorable, entrepreneurial, more government cooperative.
So they're open a place over here.
And so they spent $363 million to buy a parcel to go buy a $1 billion building downtown.
I'm super curious about your investment thesis. And I just wanted to actually ask you something that you mentioned before, but I didn't actually get a chance to double down on it. So you mentioned earlier that you look for companies that disrupt themselves, basically. And I know this theory because I've spoken to Salim Ismail, from Singularity, and you know Peter Diamandis, and their concept is they actually help companies disrupt themselves from within, and they take a novel concept, or if you acquire a company, they move that idea to the fringe of the organization so it can mature and develop, and the larger organization doesn't have an autoimmune reaction to this smaller startup within it, and then that idea, if it works out, then they bring it into the main organization again, and then they allow that idea to grow and to foster, and then eventually you have companies that really do disrupt themselves. Apple does as well. Google does as well. I'm sure Meta does as well. But the question that I have is, you look for that in an organization, but how do you look for that activity or that behavior when you're going in at a much earlier stage?
So you're looking for, well, I have my ultimate hack, and my cheat sheet is just back. You got to find superhumans. You're all the simple venture capital, and I'm doing more crossover now, but the simple venture capital recipe is you find a superhuman that has a superhuman mafia with superhuman coaches that are going after total addressable markets that are not too far away, where you can really believe that that team can take an ownership position and build a moat and then grow from there, and they're scalable, right? So having the experience on the team, you know, no different than the PayPal mafia.
Yeah.
You know, they had the ability to scale and then reinvent themselves, right? You know, look at Mark. Mark had to go from a social media company to a mobile company to an AI company, which he really is an AI company, you know, and then he's setting up his.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
You know, virtual reality companies. So
it's just behavior derived from the smartest people, the superhumans.
You know, and you can really see who's scalable.
How do you know, though, that they're going to be super? Because when you're a startup, you can adapt and change, and you can zigzag.
Well, not everyone. That's why
not everyone. Do you know that once they're going to scale, they're going to be able to adapt and mutate and get better in the new environment? And just what are your, when you say it's a hack, okay, but what are your KPIs to say, okay, that makes sense? He kind of like checks on all those parameters.
So it's really hard early
to
decide that. So depending on the stage. So if I took, when I backed Zuckerberg and realized what ingredients did he have? So when what I saw in him is I built something that he's already got so much virality to his app, he's going to be big. Right. The question is, can he monetize? Can he shift to mobile? Those are the big bets. He had Peter Thiel. He had a world-class board. Mm-hmm. He had Reid Hoffman. Mm-hmm. Right. So he had the leaders and the coaches. He was able to track great entrepreneurs that have done it before, you know, either coming out of the Amazon environment like Owen Bonata did, or coming out of other enterprises. That's later. And by the way, during that period, Mark literally had Gideon Yu, who was the CFO at the time, modeling that he was charging governments to run voting systems on his platform. So you had an entrepreneur that was thinking so far ahead and able to manage my short-term solution, where I need to be for my growth, and where I'm going to be in the future. You could just see, you have the skill set to see that. But that was when he was farther along. So when I'm looking at, you know, backing entrepreneurs now, and I'll pick one, is Israeli entrepreneur. So I'm friends with Tom and Marco, who, you know, he built Viber, sold it to Rakuten for $900 million, built another online media company, and then it was the CEO of Juno, right, which is Uber in New York City. And I'm like, right entrepreneur, because he scaled to a billion, was in the wrong company because I was an investor in Uber. But I said, if this guy ever starts anything, he's got a track record, he's recruited great executives, he's smart, he knows how to get out of the way, he knows when he's in the right TAM. So I said, next time you start a company, let me just write your first check, right? So me and Benny Shoptai, I don't know if you know some of these people, but it's kind of like the Tel Aviv mafia down here. I'm not from Tel Aviv. You know, just backed him. You know, fast forward, he was going after building hydrogen production cars, saying, hey, listen, Elon Musk is going to go after electric vehicles. we're going to realize is we're going to move from electric vehicles to hydrogen powered technology, and we got to get there now. So you got to back somebody who can run through walls, great recruiting, great network. You look at their network, I call it their mafias, you know, the LiveRamp mafia, you know, where are they coming from? And, you know, and who they pick as leaders.
That's more of a mid stage. It's very hard to actually tell right away when it's a seed investor.
You know what it is? If you're one of them,
you can tell.
You've done it, right? So yeah. I'll turn it to you, right?
Yeah.
I met you, you know, on a plane, so you can backdate it. And when this was, your company was doing $10 million of revenue.
Yes.
Right? And then went on to do hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. And you just know this person.
Yeah, you did call the TPG guys that just bought Ipsen. He said, you should buy this guy right away after.
Yeah.
And then they ended up, instead of buying me for 10, 20, they bought me for hundreds.
Yeah.
So that was, and he saw it right away.
Yeah, I called Bonderman. I called the guy. They're like, I met one.
Yeah.
Right? And because if you are one and you realize how difficult it takes, you could probably go look at the reading list. If you're studying the art of war, combat, you know, or growth hacking, which I think was where you always your
big conversation.
Number 10. If you weren't studying growth hacking, you would have never got there.
Yeah, yeah. Right. You get the tools. I feel like when you know that some people have certain tools that they get excited over process, and those tools can break walls for them, because I'm the only one with a hammer. Mm-hmm. And then there are lots of walls, and like, oh yeah, I got a hammer. And that guy can keep going through. And then eventually he's going to find a path until he finds, it's just every time you build a tool, and it's just, once you see what you know what good is, I feel like it's in anything else in life, right? When you're with a woman, you know, once you know what good is, you know what good is.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's so if you had to go now and look at your past and you said to yourself, well, there are 2-3 things I would have changed, what would it be?
That's a good question. I would have stayed with investments longer, because what I realized is once you have the momentum's so hard to come by, that once that moat's being developed, once that team's being developed, I would simplify by saying you don't need to make a lot of decisions. Mm. And one of the things that entrepreneurs have is they sell their successes because they want to go do something else that's in a zone. So I would be a lot more patient, and I would think longer term into the TAMs I was going to address and the teams I was going to bet. And I look at things like I do with Magic City, like I'm willing to make a 10 to 25 year commitment to a project, and I'll make fewer decisions, but not as many decisions.
Magic City, do you see yourself doing Magic City partly because it's a legacy, it's part of your name, because that's going to be forever there and they'll know it was Bob. It was Bob's project.
Yeah, well, it's probably not from the ego sense I'm doing it. So, you know, Dragon Global's mission now is to leverage artificial intelligence and the Dragon community to evolve humanity in the world. Mm-hmm. So I study ancient civilizations, I study all the climate issues, I study all the problems that we have. And we have some dire circumstances out there that we need to harness innovators from around the world to take on some of the challenges facing humanity. If you look at population growth, you look at climate issues, you look at crime, you look at politics, we've got some major issues. So my issue is, part of my strategy is to build the collision points of the ecosystem and the platform, and one of that being real estate with a lot of collision points. So it's almost a necessary evil to be like the launch pad for the companies. I'm not doing it because, oh, my name's going to be attached to it, but I'm doing it because we need it. And I'm actually, you know, constantly visiting places like Dubai, places like Tel Aviv, places in the Middle East, you know, to be able to bridge the gap between Miami and these cities, so that we can, you know, Paris, they have Station F, and London, they have their equivalents, to really help promote entrepreneurship on a global basis.
I like it. So you feel like when you, because, you know, from the side of things, I'm thinking, if I was some 25-year-old listening to the podcast and say, look, I want to get to a point where I make money, and I hear people get to a certain place and they start thinking about, oh, humanity has a problem, I want to fix it. Aren't you focused on maximum profit? Aren't you focused on, like, what do you tell someone like that, that listened to you and said, is it really just you get to a certain age and you start thinking like this because you ask, what is life all about once you have something? Or is, why is it that people at a certain age start thinking philanthropy, changing problems in the world? Like, why is it getting to a certain part where people start thinking about this? And they don't have to be old, because Mark Zuckerberg is just the same. Like, what's the answer for that?
So what I try to coach, when it is, I'm now become the coach, not just the player, is it's not about the money. Mm-hmm. Right. And there's a happiness index that says after 75,000, you don't necessarily, more money doesn't bring more happiness. Anybody who owns five or six homes.
Was it before the inflation, or was it after? Was
it before? but, you know, it's all about quality of life, and who you're surrounding yourself with and what's your purpose. So I actually convince, you know, entrepreneurs to read the Ikigai, which is out of Japanese culture, to line up, you know, what you're good at, what you're passionate about, and think long term. Right? Because you got to enjoy what you do. Like, if you didn't enjoy the BoxyCharm experience, you could make all the money in the world, but you're going to spend.
I would have getting stuck in the middle. Oh, I have 20. Okay, that's it. I'm good. Let me go. Like, somewhere you would have stopped.
So once you do it, for you are achieving some white space that doesn't exist, which is identifying your purpose. There's another book called The One Thing, Gary Keller, who's a real estate guy, but he wrote a book called The One Thing, because, you know, a lot of problems you have, like if you're today in the data business or the AI business or generative AI, right? It's like the buffet problem, right? I can do all of these things, right? And they all make money. What do I focus on? You've got to decide what it is that you're going to fulfill. You're going to create a mission. You're going to assemble a team. You're going to build a culture. And that's what you're going to do. And you can't just focus about the money. Now you can focus, hey, I want to have something that has high gross margins, that's got repeatable, that's got a great moat, and I can look at defending myself, but you can't focus just on
I feel like when you ask yourself why people get to a certain height, if I would tell you when is the take profit time for you, 1 million, 2, 10, 20, 100, 200, people that are after the money would stop before 1 million, most people.
Yeah,
300, let me leave, yeah. So that's why money is just the beginning part for you to start. But it's not why you stay. You enjoy the process.
No, you enjoy the results. You can't motivate to stay for money, especially in a capitalist system, because all the money is typically going to the founders and the early investors, and not to the employees. So you've got to have a higher level purpose.
Accomplishing something that you've done. It's the biggest sense of accomplishment. Doesn't come, at least for me, wasn't the exit. The exit was nothing. That it's about the fact that if I'll walk into Sephora and someone's going to tell me, you're the BoxyCharm guy. The fact that they heard my company's name, that I was able to create that awareness everywhere. The fact that I'll get somewhere and people would say, they'll mention your company name in a random conversation. There is no better sense of... You basically know that people love what they have and they keep talking about that. So it is the sense that you have able to get millions to repeat a name. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. It's very, very hard, and it got nothing to do with money. And then when I'm trying to, like, when you do a viral video, when you're an influencer and you go viral, right? The success, the feeling of success that you went viral because you beat the algorithm is amazing. But when you actually get a community of people, big amount of people to all come together at the same time and talk about you, kind of like when you align all the stars, the way I would look at this is that, imagine a solar eclipse. If you look at a solar eclipse and they say, well, tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern time in New York City, there'll be a solar eclipse. What are you going to have? You're going to have 1 million people in Manhattan staring into the sky at the same time. But in order for that to happen, you need to have everything aligned. You really need to have the stars aligned. You need to have the earth, the moon, the sun in a perfect alignment right above New York City. But for that, you need to have an infrastructure of technology to let people know at the same time when it's going to happen. You have to have the science knowing that it's going to happen. And everything had to come together for that one moment when 1 million people staring at the sky. And you take one element out of this equation, you say, all right, There was no education around astronomy and nobody knew it's going to happen. Take one element. None of this is going to happen. When you put something together as an entrepreneur and everything works and you feel like you have aligned the stars, you created an impossible infrastructure and everyone are doing this at the same time, this is why you're going through all those walls. This is why you break through walls. This is why you continue. It's going to work just one more and everything has to be perfect. Per se. That's why we're doing this.
Yeah. And then the other thing that happens, which, you know, I in 2000, I'm like, okay, I made hundreds of millions of dollars. I moved to Aspen. I'm great at golf. I'm raising my family. And then all of a sudden, you're not the guy that's on the magazines or in the things or changing the world. And you're, you know, the beneficiary of that. And you kind of lose yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And I was around, you know, friends like Eddie Lampert and all these other people that were, you know, running hedge funds. And I'm like, why are you guys still working? Like, why are you still working?
Now I understand.
And then, you know, there's a sense of enjoyment of making the world and your community and your friends a better place. I do that now with donations. We're doing a tech lab in Magic City, you know, for all the kids in Magic City. We're doing global empowerments. We're raising money for the Amazon and for environmental causes. So, you know, sitting there with all those skills and not being participatory, you know, you kind of use a happiness index from, you know, giving back.
They said it's addictive. They said that even philanthropy is a very addictive act. Once you start, it's very hard to stop.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something too, though. I think that, you know, we talk about like solving social problems and world problems. Government tries to solve some, NGOs tried to solve some, but I really do believe that entrepreneurs are going to be the most effective at solving these big problems. Mm-hmm. And like philanthropy and just amelioration of like the world and improvement of the world and all these problems, I'm a big fan of investing in companies that solve for those. I think that's the most, if an entrepreneur can wrap their mind around that and like that ikigai concept. I think there's in the Venn diagram, I think there's like a third component and it's like the impact you have on the world and if it aligns with all the other two things, right? So if an entrepreneur can understand that they can build something, they can make a lot of money and then they can change the world in a positive way at the same time. And also if an investor can understand that as well, that's where everyone wins.
Yeah. And you look at people like Ray Dalio and other people that are working harder than they even did when they built their companies just in order to give back and share the experience and the wisdom, because it takes so much work. I mean, I read so many books, listen to so much stuff, you know, have so many insights with different levels of relationships about so many different topics, not to all be covered today, but it's a shame not to give back and share that, right?
Yeah.
Just like you guys are doing with your podcast.
You know, talking about giving back, a lot of successful people like to teach in universities and so on. And I'm going to switch topic to something that we both like. Okay. Remember, we're talking about aliens. we both like the topic, right?
And I was hoping we should go down that rabbit.
Yeah. So, UFOs, right? So I got in because of motherfucker Joe Rogan got into it. It's once you tell people that are serious people, if they take you seriously, they listen. If they're just happy and they had a couple of drinks, they start laughing, right? That's a thing. But once you start listening to the Bob Lazar, and you said, what the fuck? This is serious. Like, this is not. But so the last episode was with Eric Weinstein, which Eric Weinstein is a mathematician, physicist. And that was the first time that someone in that academia type came in and spoke about that, which, again, makes you... But one thing he said was, why don't we talk to Chaim Eshed, which was the previous head of the Israeli space program that teaches in the academia now, he's in his 80s. And he was the one that came and said, well, government has been in touch with aliens for a while, for many years. In fact, they're the one that stopped a nuclear war with the Bay of Pigs. In fact, there's a Galactic Federation. He said things that, what? Now, I read that in 2019. I didn't take it seriously. And then when I listened to Eric Weinstein, said, I need to try and get a hold of this guy. And I did. And I made a phone call. And I got his phone number. And I called him. Because this is not a... He still teaches astrophysicists in the university. I think the Hebrew University is, not sure. It's the first non-somebody. It's a It's a somebody. It's not a nobody. The head, he actually created the Israeli space program. And when I called, it was very nice. Hey, how are you doing? Can I help you? As soon as I told him that I want to interview him, it's like he swallowed the frog and he said, look, I spoke way too much, way too soon. I got myself into a big rabbit hole and they made sure I'm not going to say anything. And I promised them I'm going to say nothing. So I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. And I was a high rank officer in the military. And for some reason at his age, he's afraid.
Yeah.
And I said, wow.
No, it's interesting. I was recently brought a movie. Mm-hmm. It's a documentary. So one of my friends did Ready Player One, mm-hmm. With Steven Spielberg, which talks about
good movie.
Kind of where the future goes. He also produced a 60-minute episode on UAPs. And he also co-produced...
What's his name?
I'll give it to you.
Okay.
Later. I'm going to keep it confidential right now because okay. I'm going to share with you some confidential information, but he's listed as a producer in all these movies. So the most film...
I think you have to come closer.
Okay, the most filmed 60 Minutes episode is on UAPs.
Okay.
Right, and I gave you all these documents. There was a Phenoma 360, you know, which is also on UAPs. So there's a sequel that is coming out that is really going to go well beyond just having F-16 fighter pilots talk about their mm-hmm. encounters with unidentified aerial phenomena, right? Which is the old UFO to UAP. So according to this, because I looked at this with Peter Thiel and we were going to fund it. I'm going to actually do the preview of the movie. It's about 8 months away out of my home in okay. Miami. And Mark did the launch of Ready Player One out of his home in Menlo Park. So
wow,
supposedly the government is going to use this new film, right, which goes well and above all of the things that are gathered in 60 Minutes and gathered in Phenomenon, gatherings, to support the fact and open up that there has been ongoing dialogue with unidentified species for a long time. They're not going to create a sense of a emergency around it. But what they're going to do is they're going, I think the U.S., I'm going to predict here, like I predict Miami, the U.S. is going to take a position as a global country to protect intergalactic areas. And I think what they're going to do is we're going to work through between the orbit and the moon. So my prediction is that, you know, you see the government actually have higher level disclosure and take action on it to protect their world currency by investing in military that will protect against both asteroids. So you mm-hmm. have a younger, drier scenario of, mm-hmm. you know, getting hit and aliens.
Aliens
and you're going to see this, yeah, aliens, and you're going to see this come back. And this all stems from, if we study ancient civilizations, right, because I study UAPs and I study this technology, but really I spend a lot more time studying ancient civilizations. So if you look back where history used to think that we became civilized 6,000 years ago. Well, the truth is that we now have sites, you know, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey on the border of Syria, the Cappadocia Caves. You know, we have the Mu territory in Japan. We have obviously what the Incas did in Machu Picchu and the layers underneath the cities. We have the Giza pyramids. You know, if you look at the Nazca League lines in Peru, you clearly see technology, both in terms of cutting stone, size of stone, images carved on land, you know, from aerial perspectives that we didn't have access to say, hey, listen, somebody else was here. Whether we developed to a point where we were able to do this ourselves, and then that technology got wiped out 11,600 years ago, right? There is an issue where we did have more advanced technology on this planet. And so the biggest question
Are the pyramids across different continents are roughly around the same time?
Yes, it's all about 11,600 years ago. Wow. And not only is it about the same time, they're all pointing to the same direction. So if you go to look at Malta, if you look at Giza, if you go look at Göbekli Tepe, if you look at all of these structures, you go to the Incas, They're all pointing at the same Sirius 2 star system, right? Which is thought to be where we have the channeling of all the information on advanced technologies come from. So there's some a lot of interesting things. So anybody who's studying UAPs or UFOs should be studying ancient civilizations. And then there's, you know, and then the question was, is this somebody coming from a different territory, or we developed enough to have left and we're just coming back and we're watching ourselves?
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would probably
be... I'm not taking a position on this.
No, it's just fascinating. Yeah.
I'm totally obsessed with it. And it's one of those things where I actually get my hands dirty. I've climbed the pyramids to the top. I go visit the...
You have to check that there's no aliens left over there.
You're a smart guy. You've looked for the natural explanations for all the proofs, right?
Yeah. I read Apocalypse, the ancient Apocalypse, Graham. Yeah. Graham Hancock has a series on Netflix. It shows these locations. It shows the sedimentary rock, the aging of the locations. I mean, we have stuff right here in the U.S. We have a serpent in the middle of Ohio that you'd be like, what is going on
here? There's a thing that says in the Kabbalah, and I'm not religious. I never took my kids to synagogue. So it's not like I'm proud of it. I don't. But it says that when you actually read the Hebrew letters, on the first word, Bereshit, which means Genesis. They said, why does the first letter start with letter B and not letter A? It should be A as a beginning. And then there are four lines right above that, when you read it in Hebrew, which it means in Kabbalah that it's the fourth human in the second world. Interesting. Yeah.
Well, you know, we only see 59% of the moon. Right. Mm. And there's an argument, you know, and this is a little bit...
The moon does not spin, correct?
It's, no, it
spins around Earth, but it's...
It actually spins, but it rotates in our orbit so that the way we spin and the way that spin, you can't see the dark side of the moon. Yeah. There's a tilt that allows us to see 59% versus 50%, mm-hmm. right? And if you look closely at the images of the moon, and it's very, you know, disturbing on... whether a lot of the pictures of the moon, you know, were in fact taken on the moon or were they studio sets of the moon. But there seems to be edges and corners that have been erased, right? And so there seems to be a big cover up. And then the question becomes, you know, what is on the other side of the moon and what have we been able to see? And, you know, have we ever developed as a civilization enough to be on the moon prior to the 60s? And the first, you know, travel.
But you don't see. So for example, if that was a cover up, for say it was a studio set for some of those pictures, wouldn't you have another nation that would try and?
Yeah. So right now, this is what's happening. China and India are both going to the moon. They're both going to say, whatever we find, we're going to tell you the truth. We're not going to cover anything up. And one of the issues I had is that the U.S. and the Russian society, even when they were at war during the Cold War, agreed to cover up certain things around space programs and contact with aliens.
Yeah, that was something that when you listen to Bob Lazar with Joe Rogan, and I didn't keep looking at Jeremy Corbell videos and so on. It was enough for me. They were working together.
Yeah, Graham put Graham in that bucket too.
Okay.
He's on Joe Rogan as well.
He is?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't keep searching for more discussions around aliens. The only reason I kept looking at this was starting with an F-18 pilot that broke down the stories of what do they see on the North Eastern Sea when they fly and how everything started coming together where they changed the radar on the F-18 from analog to digital and where they were able to start seeing them. And it wasn't just on the radar, because radar has a lot of wrong data, but it was on the flare cameras. And even though it's not a scientific tool, he said, everything goes, once there is an object, everything goes on it, all the cameras. And they would see it consistently. And one thing that was fascinating, where he said that at one point they were working in one of the aircrafts. And every time they wanted to make, they had a maneuver that they had to do, the aliens, I don't want to say aliens, I'm sorry, the UFOs were ahead of them every time in every point that they had to fly.
And they go 13,000 miles an hour. They can travel through water. They don't have propulsion.
No, but they knew where they're going to be. So it's like they were seeing the future. If you're the formation leader and you just decide where to fly without any organized path,
yeah,
they would always fly to the direction that you're about to fly. And they said, well, how would they know where we're heading? So when you listen to... when you listen to Eric Weinstein, and it's a phenomenal discussion that talks about the academia and how it's a big red tape, anything that you can imagine about science, it's not that. And he was technically saying, look, right now we're stuck in quantum mechanics where basically we're saying time is linear instead of looking at other options, because quantum mechanics was not technically proven, but we're not allowed to deviate from that. Mm-hmm. And he breaks it down, and I might be, and I don't want to go into technical because I'm not going to do a good job, but
there's a good
I'm going to
book
butcher
on time.
I'm sorry.
There's a good book called Time.
Well, he said that what it is if you go and you look at time different, it's multi-dimensional, and it's kind of like instead of right now we're believing in a theory that says it's like a tape. You want to go from first song to the third song, you have to go through the second song. You have to move that time in. In reality, there might be another theory. There can be another theory where it's going to be like a record player where you can just move the needle to where you want. And that's what they are probably doing. Because ultimately, he said, look, if you want to be in Mars one day, it's useless because Mars is inhabitable.
Inhabitable?
Inhabitable.
Yeah.
But you need to be outside of our solar system, and you cannot, with a propulsion system, ever get there. You have to do something else. Clearly, that's not it. We're going in the wrong direction. We're optimizing something that we shouldn't optimize. And that's where, but it's not going to change until we're going to go back to physics, because we've been stuck since 1978.
Yeah.
There was no.
I told you to watch Interstellar. You haven't watched it yet.
I haven't watched it yet.
No, I know. I can tell.
I'm going to check it. I'm going to check everything.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm going to check it.
No,
out.
I know. Yeah. But you, we can bend time.
We can bend time.
Yeah. John Hagel. Go to John Hagel's Facebook page, and he just do John Hagel. He's an advanced scientist studying all the other scientists on how to bend the universe to change the speed in which we can travel.
Then you're not bound by the speed of light with exactly, proportion yes. And everything else, yes. Yeah. Well, listen, this is fascinating. Tell me one more thing that people need to know about you, some fun facts about you. You're an interesting person. You're obviously full of life.
I feel like
life.
There's a lot of different rabbit
there's
holes.
There's a lot of things, but tell me. So if there's any events that people need to know, it's your parties, but... tell us something we don't know about you that's exciting.
You know, I'm super passionate about longevity. Mm-hmm. So that was
the other rabbit hole that I was.
That's another rabbit hole. I don't want to go deep down, but you know, I've been spending a great deal of time studying two concepts. I think we talked a little bit earlier. One is what's called the human longevity escape velocity, mm-hmm. which is. You're going to age chronologically every year, no matter what measure of time, mm-hmm. but biologically, you're able to reverse your biological age such that for every year you go forward 1 year, if you go back a biological year, you're freezing and achieving what's called the longevity escape velocity. So I do a lot of work around cold plunging, infrared lights, from a bioscience perspective, NAD therapy, NMN therapy, Reversitol, a number of things.
How often do you do cold plunge?
Depends, because my cold plunge blew up recently, but I, you know, it's something where I think four times a week is good. I do my NovaThor bed at least four times a week.
You still do 6 minutes?
What?
I still do six minutes.
I could just roll in, you know.
Yeah, we did this. He did six minutes like a champ. Like, I was jumping after 2 minutes. I chickened out.
Yeah. So that is my biohacking bioscience. You know, I would also recommend that people read The Untethered Soul or Becoming Supernatural, which is more about controlling your flow, mm-hmm. right? Your energy outside of the human body is, you know, we project on an energy basis about 8 to 12 feet around us in 360 degrees, but mm-hmm. two poles, a north pole and a south pole, kind of like Kundalini yoga. You have your energy sources and your ability to vibrate in the flow. So I, you know, just like I do work with bioscience and biohacking, I also, you know, work with David Claire, I've been to 40 years of Zen. I work on, you know, where do I vibrate energetically and how do I stay in my flow? Because when you really get to it, you become a successful entrepreneur, or you be anything you do where you really, really get into flow, you realize the most important thing is to be in a more meditative state, you know, be more, you know, in your theta state or in your, mm-hmm. you know, and vibrate in a way where you're actually creating.
This is so hard to get to that state.
And you're attracting.
It's very hard to get to that state consciously. Right? You're doing it consciously, you can get to that stage.
Yeah. So Joe Dispenza mm-hmm. has a book called Becoming Supernatural, which he teaches you through meditation and some of the self-help. But once you realize that you can manifest your reality and you can actually work with the universe, you realize then when as a leader and you're building companies to extrapolate just to that level or longevity, that goal setting, your relationship mapping, these are so important. You know, and staying in the flow and trusting the universe and trusting yourself is where a lot of people break down. And we have an epidemic, I think, around anxiety. Mm-hmm. And we have an epidemic around people now who really, you know, are getting coined. You know, you got to learn about resiliency. So one thing at building companies, you're going to fail. If you're a great entrepreneur, you're always going to live in an uncomfortable spot because you're always trying to build something bigger and better that hasn't been done. So trying to live there where you're happy and you're comfortable and you're not anxious and you stay in flow and you're setting goals and you're empowering your team and you're building great culture, you know, those are the things of, you know, being in your flow. Now you might say, hey, it's a lot easier because you got the big house and you're successful and you're not stressed out. The one thing is enjoy the process and stay in the flow and don't get anxious.
Well, I agree. And I think that when you said something about getting into a particular state of mind, I felt like there were a couple, there's sometimes those Zen moments for me where I can come up with a much more clear thought. And I wasn't able to, and still now, I don't know how to consciously get to it. But usually it happens while I'm half asleep. Half awake.
Half asleep.
And that's where somehow there is less input of thoughts into my head, because I cannot meditate. I cannot concentrate while I meditate. Mm-hmm. I can actually do the breathing more like a Wim Hof method. That's when I'm in much better state instead of meditation. But when I'm half asleep, there's that moment that I know that now I should think about what I need to think about. Exactly. Because I don't have all the input of every thought out there in the day. It's clear. And I can be so much better. All that creativity comes at that moment. It just amplified.
Yeah. The other thing I want to add, because I would hate to do a podcast and not talk about, you know, I have three beautiful daughters and I have a 1-year anniversary with my girlfriend. So also having Congrats. Great women around you.
And I met her and she's amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
yes.
Having great women around you and... you know, really appreciating that is something.
I feel like women around you definitely complete us, right? Because they think so different than us, and they'll cover our six when we're doing something. They'll see what we can see, and we'll see what they don't see, and we can work so much better.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, Bob, listen, that was amazing. That was great.
Thank you.
Really, really good. Thank you so much.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.